Okay, I'd like to get this session underway now. Thank you. Thanks for taking your seats. Can I just remind you the format of the session, we have two speakers, Chris Durack and Wade Mattison. They're basically going to do a bit of a song and dance act together rather than have two presentations, so it's a joint presentation with a little bit of interactivity there. We'll allow at least 15 minutes, hopefully 20, for questions. Can I ask, when you do have questions, if you come to the microphone and state your name and where you're from, because the sessions are being recorded, and kind of remind you to ensure you give the feedback for the session, either directly on the paper or electronically. With no further ado then, I'll introduce Chris Durack. He's a director and head of product and distribution at Schroders in Sydney. Joined Schroders in October 2011 from New South Wales State Super, where he was CEO from February 2009. New South Wales State Super is one of Australia's largest super funds, with more than $30 billion in assets under management. Chris has significant funds management experience gained between 2004 and 2009 through senior roles with two large fund managers, Perpetual and Challenger. And in addition to a career in funds management, he's also held senior research and consulting roles at Mercer and Towers Perrin. He has degrees as long as my arm, mostly in Australian unis. Welcome, Chris. Wade Mattison, a principal and leader of Millerman's Australian practice. He joined them in 2004 and is responsible for the development, delivery and oversight of their Australian operations across product development and retirement, as well as risk and capital management service lines. He's got over 15 years actuarial experience in life insurance and wealth management, and involved in a range of projects across the globe. He's worked actively with clients in Asia, Europe and North America. Prior to establishing the Australian practice, Wade was based in Millerman's London office. So you can see that you have today two very experienced and eminently qualified gentlemen to debate what is a very topical topic on the life cycle investing, and it's obviously been made even more topical by various announcements to do with MySuper in particular and what's been in the press in recent times. So pass over to Chris and Wade. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for the introduction. You've set the benchmark nice and high. I particularly noticed the 20 minutes at the end of the presentation for questions, so we might have to move along at some pace. Just by way of introduction, what we're aiming to cover in our presentation is really to have a look at what this debate about life cycle investing really is. And in fact, given that Wade and I are doing a song and dance routine as we promised at the start, there's a lot that we in fact agree on. And in particular, what we agree on is that things probably do need to change. And we have seen a lot of coverage in the media and through recent reviews on these topics. So there are some issues that we do agree on, and we'll cover those off very quickly as well. What we'd also like to do is cover off on some of the approaches that we're seeing emerge in the market here, and have a look at what they mean in terms of member objectives, particularly as we move closer to retirement and into post-retirement. And then, because both of our firms that we represent do have offerings or solutions, if you like, in this space, we might draw out some of the areas where we don't perhaps agree, or perhaps illustrate where there may be more than one way to skin a cat, and that might help the debate along. So that's the broad structure of what we're going to cover this afternoon. I guess just a couple of other introductory remarks, or at least some context here. Why is this topical? Why are we even having the debate? We've just gone through a period of crisis in markets. We've had superannuation funds reporting returns, particularly over longer term periods, which have been below expectations. Of course, this has fueled debate about what funds are truly accountable for and how that can be improved. Obviously, the regulatory reforms that have come forward have focused on this area, and in particular, MySuper has had a lot to say about this. We have also heard APRA come forward and say that with their expectations for standard making powers, the level of risk that trustees are taking are going to be scrutinised further than what they perhaps have been. And in particular, we are operating still, I think, in a framework where fixed strategic asset allocations are the dominant way of investing. And there have been some concerns about that, particularly, as I say, when you approach retirement or you get into post-retirement, this can lead to problems, including those of path dependency. The order of when returns are generated can matter vastly to a particular cohort of investors as they move through. We've seen a lot of high-profile commentary on the reliance on equities as well in this debate, including former prime ministers and treasurers, and that has led to a renewed focus on bonds and equities. And so there are some issues there in terms of teasing out the risks and what that means for investors meeting their objectives going forward. Wade.
Okay, so this is the second part of song and dance. So I guess, you know, to cover off some of the areas where we're vehemently in agreement, I think it's pretty much well accepted that things essentially need to change. And I guess at the crux of the problem, if we look at traditional default structures as a starting point, essentially, people outside of a choice environment end up invested in the same strategy regardless of whether they're 25 or 65. So, if you think about that in terms of what actually happens to an individual fund member over their lifetime, which is the chart on the left-hand side, essentially we're replacing human capital over time with financial capital. So human capital being my ability to earn income into the future. As I transform that into a tangible asset, it increases. So the argument that, sequence of returns doesn't necessarily matter, that we can all be invested for the long term, you can see it through that financial capital line alone that, you'd much rather get a strong positive return and vice versa, avoid large negatives when that financial capital is at its peak. So the risk profile that individual investors experience over time as they go through this financial life cycle changes, and the chart on the left talks to that a little bit. Risks are very lengthy in terms of the number of risks that people are exposed to. Each one's different. I think we had a presentation a little bit earlier about financial planning and objectives and things of that nature. It's going to be very different across different groups of people, different cohorts, even potentially down to individual preferences. So I think accepting that, then the question becomes, well, what can we do about it? Which I guess is what we'll try and touch on later.
So I guess just to follow on from Wade's comments about the different risks that investors face at different parts of their life cycle, this is really a re-expression of what Wade's just put up, but this area where investment risk really hits its peak as investors have accumulated assets and they're close to retirement and moving through retirement, if you have a look at the common default options for these investors in the industry now in superannuation, what we're still seeing is fixed strategic asset allocation portfolios, either a balanced or a conservative balanced mix of growth and defensive assets, designed to meet largely two classes of risk, one being, of course, the investment risk that an investor faces. So if you think about taking no investment risk and having no volatility right up through to, say, an equity level of risk, and then have a look at, on the other axis here, running a portfolio to meet an entire life cycle worth of needs, it doesn't appear to be an optimal approach to be sticking with a fixed SAA framework. And why is that? Well, in the real world, we observe that risks in asset classes are non-stationary. Depending on when you invest in equities will largely depend on the outcome that you earn. And that's exactly the same in bond markets as well. I mean, if you're thinking about de-risking from equities at the moment, you'd be, in our view, underdoing the problem to not think about bond market valuations at this point in the cycle as well. So fixed SAA, as we would observe, largely ignores valuation conditions in markets and the fact that risks vary through time. And just to, I guess, underline or agree with Wade's comment about different outcomes for different cohorts of people, in our view, that's what drives these different outcomes depending on what stage of life you're in and what part of time you're moving through depending on where asset markets are as well.
And so very quickly, you know, the question is, well, why are we now focusing on this with renewed vigour? I guess I'll look at these 3 points. Chris has another point to add to that. But demographics, I think, plain and simple, that, you know, we're seeing that massive shift now from the baby boomer cohort from accumulating into retirement income drawdown. They're the people who are essentially most exposed to these sorts of risks. At the same time, we've gone through an experience where Australian superannuation fund members have realised that investment markets inherently do carry risk with them. I guess over the past 15 years it wasn't probably obvious to them. So funds are trying to react to that in terms of how do they smooth out their members' experience over time. And then I guess the final point is with the amount of money that's in motion, you know, these are simply kind of changes in those age buckets based on numbers. If we scale that up by the actual assets under control of those different cohorts, then it magnifies the issue. So the competition for those you know, those retirees or pre-retirees is going to become more intense and drive, we think, organisations to look to try and solve these types of problems.
Look, the only point that I'd offer in addition is if you look at, again, fixed strategic asset allocation frameworks and you apply that to solve a problem that a member has at a point in time, you can have a look at or you can have an experience of the 1980s where you get a very nicely behaved, efficient frontier where risk is rewarded in proportion to the growth assets you're investing in, and that might form the basis of your expectations. Certainly in textbooks, that's what you'll observe. What we would offer in response, though, is that if you look at the 20 years beyond the 1980s, you've got a different outcome. Now, I mean, I have to qualify this chart by saying the scale on the left-hand side is very condensed, but it still makes the point, I think, that you don't get risk reward for risk evenly distributed across time frames. So the point being here that if you are investing in equity markets, let's say, in different periods of time and lengthy periods of time, you'll get a very different outcome.
And I guess, you know, we'd sort of labelled the presentation as the life cycle investing debate, and I guess just to clarify that, I suppose the way Chris and I sort of look at this is, you know, essentially the fact that people need to change their strategy over time to meet a various range of goals. I think as an industry, when we talk about it, we start to think about US target date funds and very specific structures. You know, and I think really that's just a discussion around, well, what's the vehicle to try and solve these types of problems. And so adding an additional layer onto that, if we accept the premise that people's investment strategies do need to change and need to be more relevant to their goals and objectives, then the next natural question is, well, is there a single solution? Are there multiple solutions? And what's going to drive those types of factors? So, you know, two that stand out to me are simply, am I going through a choice or an advised model, or am I looking at a default or an autopilot environment, which is essentially a sort of a my super type world? So, you know, when you start to ask those sorts of questions and, you know, things that come out of that are, in an autopilot environment, do you have access to information, sufficient information about those members or member cohorts to default them, you know, in an accurate way or in an appropriate way? Do you start to look at bundling solutions where you can potentially have a solution that's a lower cost vehicle versus unbundling some of these issues, which may end up as a higher cost vehicle but might actually more explicitly target the needs of individual members? So I think that's where the debate's going to sort of naturally evolve outside of, you know, product per se, into how do we sufficiently life cycle people across these different market segments.
And perhaps another way of looking at that issue is if you approach the problem from a product-driven angle, and what you'll see in the market at the moment are a number of different solutions. So you can have annuity, lifetime term annuity, and a whole range of what purport to be life cycle solutions. Or you've got to be careful about the definitions you're using when you're talking about life cycle, because everyone's got a life cycle. It just depends on how you're framing the particular product. So on the right-hand side, I've really just isolated some of the risks that people need to be thinking about when they are looking at these products and ensuring that they are properly addressing the objectives that people are trying to achieve. One of the earlier slides I was referring to is longevity risk, and the other being investment risk. If you are a particular investor looking to perhaps annuitise your portfolio, The one risk that's obvious that you should be bearing in mind is how expensive that is, not in its own right, but as an opportunity cost type solution as well, particularly at the point in time that we're at with markets at the moment. If you're thinking about term annuities, then obviously what we're dealing with is a structured credit type vehicle, and all the usual caveats that go with structured credit vehicles need to be considered as part of the due diligence in going in. So, I mean, I'm not putting the knife into these things. All I'm saying is that they need to be evaluated in the context of all the available solutions. And again, I mentioned the problems with fixing on an SAA because that doesn't reference valuation. So if you have a rules-based solution which is just designed to glide you into a lower risk portfolio, irrespective of what valuation conditions are present in markets, then that's also something to be wary of. So the orange box at the bottom of that slide is really meant to just draw attention to the fact that we need to start off with member objectives rather than try and funnel a product down as a mass solution without referencing what exactly the outcome is going to be.
And look, this is just an, kind of a similar example where, you know, some of the reaction from the risk in equity markets, for instance, has led itself to calls that funds are overweight equities and need more bonds and so on and so forth. And I think, you know, that's a fine angle to take and to consider it as a risk mitigation vehicle. I guess we would also suggest that, you know, when you're considering this, if you consider that, that financial capital build-up where it reaches at a peak where returns really matter and retirement is now a long period, then you need to consider, well, we can't just simply de-risk there. We need to maintain a balance between risk and growth. And so one potential example is look at equity markets but then hedge particular equity market risk to try and preserve upside. So you consider the opportunity cost you have that comes with de-risking. And can I simply, through alternative means, can I look at ways of creating a risk-return profile that's more consistent with the profile that members have? Because it's, you know, fundamentally members are, and I guess the population in general, is asymmetric. They want absolutely no downside but all the upside. Well, that's impossible, but can we find a way of giving them less of the downside but still preserve some of the upside? So we've looked at it in different approach to say, well, perhaps looking at managing equity market risk might be a viable alternative.
So again, I'll just continue on with the line of thought that any solution in the life cycle space needs to reference the broader range of investor circumstances. So this is going to add some complexity into the debate. We've got a whole range of issues that need to be taken into account, including other non-superannuation assets, typically the owner-occupied house, the level of liquidity and access to capital, and I'd probably add the income-generating capacity of the portfolio to that. How much risk investors are comfortable in investing out to the end of their life, so that will govern how much insured and how much uninsured risk is going to be taken on, and of course the social security system as well. So all of these factors, when we're thinking about products or solutions to a life cycle portfolio, also need to be taken into account.
I guess moving on to sort of things to consider implementation, obviously we talked about the market segments, but I guess expanding briefly, obviously, you know, I think there's an approach where there's a universal toolkit that you may need, and it might be annuities or different asset allocation strategies. I think the reality is to build that complete toolkit up front becomes challenging, to say the least, expensive, particularly when you're managing resources. So what we're starting to see now is funds sort of try and hone in on the short-term opportunities to move this forward. I guess, you know, if you're looking at funds outside of insurance companies, then, you know, the questions around what product solutions they bring to market and what are the implications. Does it include long-term counterparties and potentially legacy risks where you build up multiple suppliers of different products over time? Do you have ability to actually intelligently autopilot your members? Where we're in a market where the average person has, you know, multiple superannuation accounts, can you actually, you know, with confidence say we know we're their only provider, or if you're not, that you're their major provider? distribution and advice comes into play if you're starting to look at more sophisticated solutions. I guess, you know, our view is really looking at where the gaps are in that toolkit and then strategically identifying where the short-term opportunities are where you can make a meaningful difference, and then looking at a longer-term strategic, you know, path where you'll ultimately end up.
And I suppose this is where we do start to see different solutions coming forward. I mean, where we are looking at the investment problem, what we're suggesting is that there is a need to go more directly to the outcomes that investors or members of funds are looking to achieve, rather than to focus on a process and hope that that gets you to an appropriate outcome. And to do that, there is a need for more transparency, I think, in terms of what is proposed in a particular solution and what you're going to be accountable for delivering. So here's an example of an investment solution that we currently run. I'm not putting this up here as any kind of product flog. I'm just putting up there as an issue of transparency or identifying objectives that members may find appropriate for their own particular circumstances. So in broad terms, a real return objective, we talked about path dependency and the fact that as you build a book of assets to a substantial degree, this has this is influenced much more by investment market outcomes. So being very clear about the level of volatility that you can withstand, and in particular how much in terms of capital loss, whether it's mark to market or realised, is appropriate as well. And as I say, people do have a range of views across markets of what will present some stability in terms of return profile, but that needs to go hand in hand with the consideration of liquidity as well, because we are talking about portfolios that are funding out lifestyle obligations as well. And again, I mean, I would perhaps highlight the definition of risk here. I mean, we commonly talk as an industry about risk in terms of volatility, and what we really mean, or what we really should be focused on when we talk about risk, is the chance of not delivering or failing members in terms of what we're accountable to deliver to them. So again, I mean, what does that mean in a portfolio context? In terms of an overall fund and differentiating this type of investment solution from a more traditional fixed SIA-driven solution, the key points of difference would be to make sure that the period of return target is made clear, and also to be appropriately liquid and diversified across the asset classes in the portfolio. But also, here is the part of the solution that really pulls away from what's more traditionally in place in default solutions at the moment. It's not a fixed strategic asset allocation approach. We've seen time and again that fixed SAA will determine or give rise to very different outcomes across time and across market conditions. So you can't, in a way, have your cake and eat it too over shorter term periods. You've either got to address or fix on the SAA, or you've got to fix on the outcome, but not both. And again, what does that really mean in terms of portfolio outcomes, or what you could expect perhaps to see in an approach like this? I've just shown an asset allocation of the Schroder Balanced Fund, which is a fixed SAA-driven product, against the real return product. And you can see there that the allocation to equities is vastly different across the two portfolios. And why is that? Well, I have to say, first of all, that our expectations for equity markets are reasonably positive over the next sort of 3 to 5 year period. But as we all know, equity distributions have fat tails and are wide anyway. We don't claim any special foresight in being able to fix on a particular point in that distribution, but rather we use that part of the distribution that's necessary to get us to real 5% and no more. So buying assets that are targeted to get you to the objective and where you want to go is really more about tightening the distribution around the mean of what you need to achieve, rather than being a return maximiser and hoping that that's what delivers a good outcome to investors.
And I guess just to give you some context in the way we tend to view it, probably slightly different to Chris, and probably for a few other reasons, is I guess we fundamentally see that there's huge inertia in the market in terms of trying to, you know, see the market move dramatically to change its existing processes. So given that, you know, we've looked at it more from an enhancement perspective, how you can begin to start with the sorts of approaches that are currently in place and then enhance what they've got from a risk profile to create more member-specific or objective-specific approaches. And obviously that balances things like cost and speed and so on. And then I guess in terms of examples, I think going back to sort of the life cycle example in the United States, so when we traditionally think about life cycling, we think about target date funds in the US. And so, those funds, despite sort of renewed discussion around them in Australia, they performed quite poorly through the US. There was a congressional hearing. There's all sorts of uproar around the performance of these funds that were designed to manage risk. What we're starting to see now is, as a vehicle, a collective vehicle that grouped people together with a similar investment horizon, similar objective, it was a low-cost vehicle. And we're seeing now the next generation of those funds come about where they start to manage risk more explicitly. So it's things not dissimilar to what Chris is talking about managing volatility over the life cycle of the fund, looking at managing downside risk, those types of things. So very similar, but marketed in a slightly different way. Step that forward, where we look maybe more in a retailer or advisor or an explicit marketing perspective, and then we see product solutions like this, which are essentially try and strip out the risk management piece and run that completely in isolation from the underlying fund. So it would be akin to having a default fund and then having the ability to add an option to that default fund in the Australian market that would manage market risk, for instance, or tack longevity risk or something onto that. So that becomes very different. It's very individual in nature. It's very tailored. It's turned on or off, those sorts of things. Adds flexibility and transparency. So they're the sorts of things we're starting to see. It's overlaying on top of the existing investment process that exists and trying to target it in a better way to the actual needs of your clients. And probably this point's common for both Chris and I, is really then what you start to do is you look at it from the perspective of, can I meet my objectives? Does having this strategy give me more confidence in meeting my goals? So, deliberately here, looking at a withdrawal profile, we're focusing on the probability that your assets are depleted. So starting to overlay and make the investment strategy more resilient across broader market scenarios increases the probability reduces the probability that you run out of money. So when you start looking at the world in that context, then you get away from some of the other parts of the discussion around products and so on. You're really focusing on member goals and do your investment strategies actually give you the ability to meet them with greater confidence? Sorry, that's me. So two slides remaining. As we said at the outset, we're in agreement. Things need to change. It's not particularly a debate anymore. The question is really how do we start to change the existing processes that are in place? I think you need to look at this more holistically. We need to take into account things like the age pension, potentially members' ability to draw down home equity as longevity hedges, ultimately. I think deferred annuities, and there's a lot of debate and discussion around making those products available, so they make sense in various circumstances. Term annuities, I think as we start to reframe the problem, then there becomes a natural place for annuities of all types of descriptions and a wider range of products than we've currently got access to.
Look, I just come back to the point that if you're fixing on a process or you're fixing on a strategic asset allocation and hoping that will deliver a good enough answer for members across all time periods, rather than it being appropriate or giving a suitable outcome for some members across some time periods, then the problem does need to be rethought. So having a greater focus on the outcomes that are generated and being accountable for them as the member balance becomes high, so pre-retirement and then through into retirement is, in our view, the way forward. There are solutions emerging and there's no consensus here, and I think that's probably a healthy thing, that the model in post-retirement is being contested. I mean, Wade and I have got different approaches, but recognise, I think, the common aspects of the problem. I guess, the real issue, as far as we would see things in investment terms, is that if you are going to again, sort of adopt a fixed approach in asset allocation, it ignores two things really fundamentally. One is the time-varying nature of risk, and the other is that in a lot of life cycle approaches that we've seen, and particularly those in the US, which in some ways and in some instances spectacularly came unstuck, was that they weren't referencing valuation conditions. They were rule-based that generated outcomes which weren't satisfactory. So that means that, you know, in our view, these solutions need to recognise valuations, or if you are going to buy an insured solution, take a view on the valuation that that solution implies. And with all that together, if I can end on a note of agreement, the current default settings as we see them today really do need to evolve beyond where we see them. We think it's a healthy thing that there are solutions emerging.
Thanks very much, both Chris and Wade. That I'm sure that we've all found that quite thought-provoking. I know when I came heading up for this session, I was thinking it was a debate about whether to have life cycle investing or not. And after discussion, it became obvious it wasn't whether, but when and how to do it better. I think, sort of in the back of my mind at least, it's quite obvious that there's a need out there and the difficulties are around the practical aspects of it. But can I invite you then to, I think there's so much information there, I'll be very surprised if there's not quite a few questions or comments. So if I can invite you to come to the microphone to ask your questions and make your comments. Thanks. And please state your name and where you're from beforehand and speak into the microphone for recording purposes.
Nick Khalil Towers Watson. Thanks, guys. Really interesting stuff there. Just to continue, Chris, probably mainly on the line that you were pushing there about perhaps moving away from benchmarks as an idea. Just some comments that perhaps challenge that a little bit, and interested in your thoughts on these. And I wonder if, you know, to start with, you know, there's a bit of a lesson from that target date experience we had in the US that you both mentioned a number of times. And, you know, basically what was happening there was, you know, target date funds under a single label had a wealth of things happening beneath them. Some of them had sort of 20 or 30% in US equities, and others had 80 or 90%, all under the banner of target date funds. So, and that clearly is what surprised a lot of the investors in those when the GFC came. So I guess to your sort of proposal that perhaps we don't have benchmarks and have an objective-based set of outcome, or sorry, an outcomes-based set of objectives for the underlying investment. I just wonder that makes perfect sense to me to a well-informed investor who can agree with those objectives, understand the process that someone's using to actually achieve those, and then sort of buy into that. But when we're talking about, you know, in my thinking anyhow, largely how do we solve these very difficult issues for a cohort of default investors who are by definition disengaged. You know, the transparency that comes from having an anchor, if you like, is something that, from a trustee point of view, to me is a great protection as against a set of objectives that might be quite defensible, but the strategy being used to those is really a black box. And just in passing, before I get your comments, I mean, as we all know, there's a paradox in this, in the sense that what I'm saying is that you need more transparency for the disengaged investors who've sort of chosen not to actually be engaged. But I think what I'm thinking is from the fiduciary's point of view, they need that. Otherwise, they'll be even more reluctant than they are now to actually sort of take part in these sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree with anything you've just said. I think we've had, as a firm, our experience has been a lot of engagement on this issue and the issues that drive the portfolio thinking. Our clients would range from large institutional investors through to retail investors. So the option makes a big contribution to portfolio thinking. But in every case, that's gone with quite a lengthy due diligence discussion about how you get your head around you know, these issues when you are asking people to pull away from a fixed anchored point. So the point I made before about, well, what is it that you're after? I mean, are you after a real rate of return over some reasonable time frame, and do you want to fix on an SAA? Well, those three things don't hang together. So analytically, I think you've got to take people on a bit of a journey. And I'm not suggesting that we're right and the industry is wrong. I'm not suggesting that at all. I think we're just suggesting that if you take a lot of equity risk on board in your portfolio, you need to understand that you may need to be extremely patient before that finally pays you off. So there is a need to be transparent. We acknowledge that, and that's the path of engagement that we've taken with this.
Yeah, I'll probably just add to that, you know, that through that static process, there were benchmarks attached to that as well, but you know, QSuper is a good example. They do a presentation, and I think Rosemary's got a slide which charts their ability, you know, when they actually hit their CPI plus benchmark over time, and the times they actually hit it are very few and far between. So I guess it's a question of what comfort or confidence do we have in those benchmarks that we set, and I guess from our perspective, I take your point and agree with it that we've got this, you know, this kind of strong anchoring bias to the way we've operated in the past, and then you know, from our perspective, looking at that, and say, well, how do you operate with that, and is it trying to add layers on top to preserve, you know, rather than try and fight that battle and try and get people to change, take a step change in their process, you know, layer incrementally on top the ability to tailor and fine tune the strategy. So
it's the 5-minute bell, so we probably have time for about 3 questions, as long as we keep them a little bit shorter, I think. Yes, Anthony.
I really like the Schroeder fund. One of the funds I'm involved with, it's got money in there, but it's a small fund, isn't it? About a couple of hundred million at max.
It's about a billion at the moment.
A billion now. But the question is, you've got, what would happen if it became popular and everyone went in the same direction? Wouldn't you find the significant mispricing that has led to the crashes that we've had in the equity market actually just being transferred to these other markets, because you've got a whole lot of less than informed investors fiddling around with the price?
Well, I think to face that particular problem you're alluding to, I think would imply a very, very large FUM that we're nowhere close to being here and don't expect to be. But having said that, I think that what we're trying to focus on here is the problem that we need to solve. So, for example, if we're trying to find a way for a portfolio solution designed to meet an acceptable and prudently struck real return over a reasonable time frame, then that's what, you know, the risks are drawn out that may prevent you from getting to that approach. So, for example, the question does often come up about what happens if equity markets rally from this point. Aren't you going to miss out, and isn't the traditional model going to win? Well, the answer in some ways is the same. I mean, this approach is not referencing a strategic asset allocation. So if equities are a standout from a fundamental revaluation point of view, they can be held, but they need to be held referencing the particular outcome you're seeking. So I'd, in a way, respond to your question in the same way. I guess in the end, if you were managing the entire market, you know, then there'd be things to take into account. We're nowhere near that. We don't expect to be.
Are there further questions? Or comments? Yes.
Rizwan Ali from One Path. You're talking about an asset allocation which moves with time. Do you see any development of portfolio insurance type solutions where you have asset allocations moving between, say, bonds and equities and property, depending on the performance that's just been? So really trying to shift back and forth, because that appears to me to be relatively transparent. I mean, we talk about disengaged people. They probably become more disengaged if products are complex. Is that something you see developing in the market?
Yes, that's fundamentally a feature of, I think, all the solutions is adding not just valuation elements to which assets to purchase, but also trying to manage things like downside risk at the time when it, you know, fund members are most sensitive to it. And then it's a question of sort of how do you implement that? So, you know, by that simple act of trying to manage that risk at an individual level, you've introduced path dependency. So you can try and do it in a fund as long as everybody's got a similar time horizon or you're focused on very short-term risk. And I guess that's one of the solutions where that was up on the screen, which is looking at managing that risk, but managing it for individual investors, so individually tailored type overlays. And you know, CPPI and I think some of the investment banks are looking at individually tailored CPPI type mechanisms as well as an alternative to more explicit equity market hedging programs.
Yeah, I think it's obvious that for the choice investor and for the individual well-advised member, there's an awful lot to be gained, and I think the difficulty for the industry potentially is bringing that to life for the disengaged members. And Wade, on your sort of style of product in particular, can you say a little bit about how that could happen for a single option, MySuper type option as an example?
Yeah, sure. I actually think there's a bit of a contradiction in a sense that we sort of say if you're a choice member, then you have an ability to take on a more sophisticated strategy that actually manages to your objective. But if you don't pay attention, you just get lumped in with what everyone else does. So you know, in a sense, the argument against sophistication for a default member, well, they're disengaged to begin with, so why can't I give them something a bit more sophisticated? Are they paying attention? Really, there's more incentive for me to manage their objectives. I think where the sophistication trade-off comes in is that sophistication by its nature is potentially more expensive. So then you're looking at this fee kind of balance, and I guess ways that I'd see that potentially emerging is you know, by the same token, if risk is more prevalent to an individual member at a point in time, then maybe they don't need to hunt down alpha and have hedge funds and active managers in there, and you can focus on offlaying some of the costs associated with those types of investments with more explicit risk management. So I think you can't necessarily dismiss it out of hand, I guess is the point.
Okay, thank you very much, both Chris and Wade. I think it was very interesting, very thought-provoking. Can I ask you to thank Wade and Chris in the usual fashion? Thank you.